Welcome to the Combat Morale Podcast with me, your host, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The Combat Morale Podcast explores what motivates people to fight or not fight in armed conflict. A quick disclaimer before we get to the action. The views expressed by any of the guests on the podcast are purely of a personal nature, do not represent the views or opinions of any organisation or government. With that disclaimer out of the way, it is Season 2. Episode 23. On today's podcast, I talk to Sean Scullion about his forthcoming book, Churchill's Spaniards. This book examines the service of former Spanish Republican soldiers who served in the Spanish Civil War and their subsequent experience in British and French forces during the Second World War. We discuss what motivated these individuals to enlist in foreign armies and fight for the Allies during the conflict. Sean spoke to me from his home in the Netherlands. Sean, welcome to the podcast. Can you start by introducing yourself and shed some light on your intriguing journey to the subject we're discussing today?
Yes. So my name's Sean Scullion. I'm an officer serving in the British Army at the moment, but actually the area of interest I have is pretty much very little to do with my day-to-day job. I'm a Royal Engineer. I was brought up in Spain. I lived in Spain during the transition, during the final few years of Franco's dictatorship. And then I was also there for the initial elements of the transition to democracy. So that part of my life has had a huge effect on my life, basically. And I've been quite heavily involved in all things to do with the Iberian Peninsula, having studied Spanish at university. Some people would say I cheated, but have been bilingual. But in essence, the Spanish Civil War, modern Spain, Spain today as well, is very much something that has marked me and had a huge effect on me. And therefore, writing a book, which is what I've been doing, I've been researching this topic for about 8 years off and on, given the fact that I'm in a full-time employment, quite tricky. But actually, the reality is that it's something that I came to realize needed to be told, and also soon after realized that I probably needed to write a book on it. So the topic is about Spaniards who served in the British Army during the Second World War. The book's entitled Churchill's Spaniards, Continuing the Fight in the British Army, 1939 to 1946. And it tells the unknown story of Spaniards who basically served in the British Army during that period under the premiership of Winston Churchill. So it's kind of controversial in some ways for some people, because lots of people who are very pro-Republican from the Spanish Civil War side are very anti-Churchill, which is understandable given the things that went on under his premiership with Spain. Conversely, a lot of people don't want to know anything about Republican Spaniards serving in the British Army because of their political bent. So, you know, it could be seen as quite a controversial topic. But actually, the reality is that this topic is about telling the story of these over 1,000. I've tracked down 1,072 Spaniards so far who served in the British Army, and the book will have every single one of them listed in the back. And really, it's about telling their story. And I think that's why this topic is very much linked to what you do with Combat Morale, because we're talking about men of a fighting age who were basically fighting. Some of them were fighting for up to 10 years. And how do you keep going? You know, that's a huge thing, really. So the book and the research I've done is all about their stories, telling their stories, how they ended up in the British Army, what they got up to, and quite importantly as well, what they did after the war. The final chapter deals with the post-war period and having to kind of come to reality with their existence and the fact that Franco was going to survive. How do you keep going and fighting, continuing this fight against fascism in exile, which they already were in the Second World War, but that continued all the way through to 1975. So hopefully that covers who I am and why I'm doing this.
So let's start in 1939, where Franco has won the civil war. It's over. And let's talk about the group that is central to your book and their motivation. So how extensive was their participation in the preceding war? And what sort of circumstances did they face, you know, once Franco had won, or it was clear he was going to win?
Yeah, so it's a pretty well known subject, really. There's lots of people who've been writing about this for some time, but it's only something that's really come together in the last 10 to 15 years in a lot more detail through the French archive. And that is the story of the Spaniards who were Republicans fighting in the Republican army. We're talking about 450,000 or so people who were forced into exile, who had to escape Spain at the end of the Spanish Civil War. So we're talking the period January, February, March 1939. There'd already been a few large groups of Spaniards who'd escaped into France. Many had returned to keep on fighting. But this final big exodus was massive. And over half, around half of that 450,000 were men of a fighting age, either fighting in the Republican army or people who were going to have to escape because of their political views. So what happens immediately is the biggest, let's say, mental torment they had to go through, the biggest problem they have to get through, is the fact that they've got to admit they've been defeated in battle and the Spanish Civil War is over. And for some of them, some of these men, it was very, very difficult, because it meant that the previous 3 years for many of them had come to an end. They've been fighting against the Spanish rebels, the nationalist forces led by Francisco Franco. And Franco basically had managed to relatively slowly inch his way around Spain and fight a series of battles, series of campaigns that ended up meaning that the Spanish Republic was split in 1938, because that he'd already got to the coast and split up the Republican side. And then he was able then to counter attack at the end of towards the second half of the Battle of the Ebro, and then push the Republican forces out of Catalonia into France. So the first thing they had to deal with was this full idea of defeat. And they were disarmed straight away as soon as they crossed the border. Quite a few of them were able to get families over, but the families and the men of a fighting age were split up. Men, women, children, elder people were all split up and sent to different locations. And it was the men of a fighting age that were incarcerated, let's say, that were held in a series of what the French called concentration camps, immediately over the border in France, on the beaches and immediately inland. And the conditions in these camps were pretty horrendous. So they'd had to hand over their weapons, their units were disbanded, they were separated from their families if they were able to get their families over. And therefore, that defeat, that shock of defeat, was probably the first big thing they had to get their heads around. Second to that, then, it was about survival and what happens next. And in the camps, there was a lot of disease and a lot of illness. Initially, we're talking the middle of winter, 1939. The conditions were pretty horrendous because the French didn't actually build any camps initially. A lot of the members of a lot of these fighting men of a fighting age were forced to build a lot of the accommodation that they lived in. So then the next kind of big deal for them was to try and get their heads around this survival, which was ingrained in a lot of them anyway, because they've got that far. So for them, we're talking about trying to keep going, trying to keep themselves politically strong, trying to keep themselves physically and mentally strong as well. So it was really quite important for them to keep going in that regard. And not soon after the camps were set up, the French authorities, knowing that the Second World War was on its way, the French authorities, especially after the September of 1939, they started to recruit the Spaniards into a whole raft of elements of the French government to support French war machine. So we're talking about the ability to be able to serve in the French armed forces, The French Foreign Legion, for example, had a lot of recruits going in. They had a big recruiting parties going into camps, and a lot of the fairly politically active Spaniards were decided they would join the Legion because otherwise they knew they would probably be persecuted. A lot of Spaniards joined the French Foreign Legion as well because it meant that their families were able to be more, let's say, integrated into French society. There were a lot more opportunities there. The French also established a series of volunteer marching battalions, a régiment de volontaires de marche étrangère, and there were three in total, and there was a plethora of Spaniards in them. They were similar to the Legion, but they'd have different terms of service. Again, they were able to have the opportunity to have their families join, or not join them, but go into France if they had crossed over the border. By the summer of 1939, we're also talking about out of that 450,000, half had returned to Spain because they had no option really, and a lot of those were family members. And then there were three other, well, two other, well, three other options really, for the Spaniards who were in the camps. They could either join elements of the French government to work in things like munitions factories or work in the countryside. They could potentially also have the opportunity, and a lot of these did. Over 50,000 Spaniards joined what they called Compagnie de Travailleurs Étrangères, so these foreign workers companies, a bit like the Pioneer Corps in the British Army. And then the final option they had was to go back to Spain. Of course, a lot of them didn't because they were on hit lists and they knew they would be incarcerated. So that's the kind of the first element of them kind of getting their heads around things. They've then got to motivate themselves, knowing that the war's coming. And by September, of course, we're talking about a lot of them joining a lot more en masse because France is really desperate to have a lot of these people join them to help with the French war machine. A lot of them do join the French, thinking that they would also be able to continue this fight against fascism with the French. And therefore, for them, it's quite a big thing. By the end of 1939, we're actually talking about the first elements of Spaniards who start to serve or start to support the British Armed Forces, because there were some of these CTE, these Compagnies de Travailleurs Étrangères, which were also called Compagnie de Travailleurs Espagnols, kind of Spanish labor companies. There were some that were actually supporting the British Expeditionary Force. And end of 1939, you've got an example. The establishment of 185 Spanish Labour Company, which had been set up in Gurs camp in near Bayonne in southwest France, in the French Basque Country. And that's where the first load of Spaniards support the British Armed Forces. They make up 185 Spanish Labour Company, and they immediately support the British Expeditionary Force, mostly in the area of Saint-Nazaire, working the rear areas, working the railway yards, the docks, things like that. So a bit like being in the Pioneer Corps. And of course, the next stage then is everything comes to a bit of a head in May, June 1940 with the French invasion. And that's where a lot of the Spaniards who are part of the French war machine are heavily involved in the events of France in May, June 1940. Many of the members of the volunteer marching battalions fight pretty hard in certain parts, quite close to Paris, in the Champagne region, up near the Maginot Line, etc. There are examples of Spaniards in labor companies fighting as well, taking up arms. They weren't allowed to have weapons, but in the marching battalions they were, marching regiments they were, but not in the labor companies. But a lot of them do, and quite a few actually end up managing to escape, with many of the French who escaped to Britain in June 1940 as well. So you get that first kind of wave of Spaniards arriving in Britain. Some of the Spaniards from 185 company managed to join the British Army in the June-July period of 1940 as well. and they join the Pioneer Corps. They manage to escape via a Polish ship that leaves Saint-Nazaire in mid-June 1940. But the first big wave of enlistment in the British Army is in 1940. It's in July 1940, and it's Spaniards who've served in the French Foreign Legion fighting in Narvik and then in France who end up in Britain in the middle of 1940. They arrive in Plymouth on the 20th of June 1940, and then they are held in a camp along with all the other French in Trenton Park near Stoke-upon-Trent. And the Spaniards realize that a lot of the French members of the French Foreign Legion, parts of the troops they've served with, are part of this 13e demi-brigade de la Légion étrangère, the 13th half brigade, mountain half brigade, served in Narvik. They're actually going to join Vichy France, and they don't want to. So they have a series of protests, and in the end, there's a bit of a confrontation at Avonmouth Harbour on the 1st of July 1940, and they're able to join the British Army soon after. The intervention of the British is kind of paramount in that, because the French Vichy forces, obviously there's still that kind of split between those who are de Gaulle and those of Vichy who are still resident in Britain. The French, what would become the French Vichy forces, then actually state that they're going to shoot one out of every three of those 300 Spaniards that want to leave the French Foreign Legion, pour encourager les autres, typical kind of way of doing business. The British intervene, and there's a mass exodus of these Spaniards that join the Pioneer Corps. And I think the date is the 17th of July that they all enlist into the British Army. But they are armed straight away because they're already trained soldiers, and they end up being part of the potential counter-invasion force should the Germans invade later that year. There's one other group, of course, that join at the same time, the British Army, and they're miles away in the Middle East. They're members of the Spanish, but they're members of the French Foreign Legion, Spanish Republicans that have joined the French Foreign Legion, and have also in a French marching battalion, volunteer marching battalion in Syria, and they're very much in the same situation as the Spaniards who end up in Britain in the summer of 1940. They realise that they're not going to have a future in the British Army, and they have to leave. So a lot of them end up escaping Syria, and we know of 63 that sign up into the British Army in the period of July, August, and early September 1940 in Egypt. Well, in Palestine, and then they end up in Egypt, and they become the first members of the newly established 50 Middle East Commando. So that's your first. That's your kind of first wave. So you can say that they've had this shock defeat, end of the Spanish Civil War. The Spanish Civil War is over. They're demobbed from that. Really demobbed. They have no choice. They go into exile. They're imprisoned. They then have opportunities through the French system, and a lot of the men end up not staying with the French once France suffers that defeat in the summer of 1940, and then they join the British as a consequence of that. So they want to continue this fight. Their morale is continuing. They don't want to be part of a defeated army. They certainly don't want to be part of Vichy France. And a lot of the Spaniards who are in these marching battalions or who are in these labor companies sadly suffer a fairly horrendous fate. Many of them are actually physically sent that summer to Mauthausen or end up in Mauthausen. And a lot of the 4,000 plus killed in Mauthausen are from these marching battalions and from these labor companies. So they've been continuing the fight. They just happened to be sadly in the wrong place at the wrong time by the summer of 1940. Quite a few Spaniards as well also melt into the background and become the first kind of Maquis members, etc. And a lot of them are based mostly in the south, quite close to the Pyrenees from that period onwards. And then obviously that gets bigger as the Second World War continues. But you've got that first wave. They've mentally switched from being Republican army soldiers to French, and now they're in the British Army. So it's, quite a big change.
So what in a way drives them? Because it seems that that they are victims of circumstance in a way,
And are they motivated to enlist in certainly the French elements, the French army, then the British army, by the fear of no other alternatives? Or is there a very strong political motivation going through many of them?
I think it's three things. I think it's three things. It's from the research I've done, it's definitely three things. There could be more. First of all, there is the political dimension. They know that they're on hit lists. Quite a lot of them are on hit lists, especially the anarchists. They know that if they ever get close to being either stopped by the Vichy or stopped by any Germans, that they're going to be returned to Spain or worse, go to a Nazi concentration camp. So there's the political element. Quite a lot of them are very politically motivated all the way through the war. But ironically, although they talk quite disparagingly about the French and how they were treated, and don't get me wrong, they were treated pretty badly by the French in many ways. I mean, French are thrown in at the deep end, but they could have certainly done things a lot better. You know, many people have written about this quite extensively. But even though they talk quite disparagingly about the French and serving with the French and the harshness of fighting in the French Foreign Legion or in volunteer marching battalions or some of the work they had to do as members of labor companies, they actually really talk quite positively about the way they were treated by the British as well. So even though they were regarded, many of them were regarded as Reds by the British authorities, they were still allowed to sign up and join. And that brings me off to the second point, which is, yes, it was many ways a needs must scenario. I've talked about this before. You've got a scenario where you've got really well-trained soldiers, people who've fought for 3 years. They fought with the French, and now they're in the British Army. Why wouldn't you want them? And to a certain extent, there's quite a big difference between those who join up in Britain and those who join up elsewhere, in as far as there is that initial reticence from the British authorities to take them on in Britain, whereas overseas, it seems slightly differently. In the Middle East and North Africa, which we'll cover later, I'm sure, the biggest enlistment of Spaniards in the British Army was in North Africa in 1942, 43. We're talking about the British authorities having a slightly different approach to the Spaniards joining them. And then I think the third area of this is actually there are people who like being soldiers. We can't deny that fact. There are people who actually like being soldiers, and there's some people who, and although they are politically motivated, it's still quite a lot of them still were, even though they like being soldiers. They did like being soldiers, and we can see this quite a bit in some of the stories of some of the Spaniards who joined the commandos, and say, for example, the SAS, who are pretty strongly politically motivated, but still are pretty amazing soldiers and enjoy doing that as their job as such. So those are the three areas, I think, you know, kind of a needs must, the political element, and you know, kind of actually wanting to be soldiers.
So I'm so interested in the sort of political motivation, because obviously one of the big weaknesses with the Republican forces, it is so split between anarchists and trade unionists, pro-Stalinists, anti-Stalinists, and the various political machinations within these groups, which you could argue is a major reason why the Republicans lose the Civil War, or a reason. And obviously you've got all these individuals going into France with very, very different political views, some of which they might really dislike their enemies more than they would dislike Franco. I don't know whether that's true, but you know, the whole sort of Judean People's Front type of thing.
Very much so. I mean, I've come across all walks of life in my research. It must be said, though, that quite a lot of the Spaniards who joined the British seem to be ones who are, let's say, more extremely politicized in some cases. A large amount of anarchists, I would say, which is ironic as well. I always find I wrote an article earlier, last year, I wrote an article on Spaniards in the Spanish anarchists in the British Army, and I just found it, you know, amazing that you're able to talk about that in that way. But actually, when it comes to the end of the Spanish Civil War, a lot of these people were thrown together, and you've got to also remember that it's not just the political side of the Spanish Republican groups. You've also got to talk about the regional groups as well. So you've got to talk about the Basques, you've got to talk about the Catalans and other groups as well, who were also exiled. They also had a, let's say, a kind of a dog in the fight in that way. And those groups also come to the fore, especially towards the end of the war, amongst the Spaniards serving in the British Army. But yes, they are from disparate groups, and they do serve together. I think the big thing that really brings them all together when they fight in the British Army, when they serve in the British Army, is the fact that they've all been singled out before they've joined the British as people who are, let's say, enemies of whatever state they're enemies of, whether it be enemies of the state Franco's New Spain that he establishes at the end of the Spanish Civil War, or whether it be enemies of or undesirables of the Vichy state, or undesirables for the Germans. They've been labeled that way, and therefore they are thrust together. And you find this a lot in North Africa when they're thrown into some horrendous conditions, and worked in labor colonies and labor battalions, labor groups as they were called in North Africa by that stage. These are all people from different walks of life, different political ideologies, but are all labeled Republicans or Reds as a consequence.
And also, is it the practice that the French and latterly the British, do they concentrate the Spanish and said, you're all Spanish, you're Reds, and they amalgamate them into one unit? So they obviously have a shared commonalities with language, culture to a degree, maybe combat experience, and that sort of way generates a sort of a unit cohesion, for want of a better word.
Well, with the French, for example, they had no choice. They had tens of thousands of Spaniards serving in their armed forces, so they had to bring them together in some way. When it came to the Spaniards in the French Foreign Legion, for example, they really did not want them to be in groups. They really didn't. So they were penny pockets of Spaniards, although of course they did stick together. The largest number of recruits joining the French Foreign Legion in 1939 and 1940 was Spaniards. I think it's something like 20, 26%, 28%, something like that, maybe a little bit more. But actually, the reality is that still makes up a very small amount of the overall force. But even then, it comes as a shock to the hard disciplinarian system that they had in the French Foreign Legion. And therefore, they were really keen to keep them split up as much as possible. With the volunteer marching battalions, well, that's a slightly different kind of scheme of things. They were set up specifically, made up of foreigners in battalions in order to fight ge the Germans or to defend France. And therefore, yes, there were a lot more Spaniards in those marching battalions, although there were Poles and there were others as well. So a similar scenario to the French Foreign Legion, I would say, but a slightly bigger mass, I would say, of Spaniards. What you did get later on with the French armed forces in the Free French is you did get whole companies of French serving in the Free French. So the most famous one is La Nueve, the 9th Battalion of one of the Chad marching battalions in Leclerc's 2nd Armoured Division. And they were part of the liberation of Paris, for example, really well documented. So there were groups like that. There weren't that many in the Free French, but there were some. And there were some Spanish troops in the French Foreign Legion that fought at Bir Hakeim in the reconstituted 13th Half Brigade, part of the 8th Army, just before El Alamein. So you've got a lot of that. With the British, in fact, I'll just cover one more thing. With the labor companies, actually, all of the labor companies were fully made up of Spaniards, to the extent that they started calling them Spanish labor companies rather than foreign labor companies. And the way it worked with a foreign labor company was they would normally have a French Foreign Legion, ex-French Foreign Legion officer in charge, with some NCOs and some junior officers. But normally, the 200 plus men in a labor company would be Spanish, and they would normally have to elect a senior officer of their own. And a lot of these were people who had been officers in the Republican Army. There's some very well-known examples. And they would be the people that would let's say, do the interchanging between the French kind of command element of the company and the rest of the company. And you get that to a certain extent with the British. So with the British, the number one Spanish company, which is established in September 1940, it's the longest serving unit. It's the unit of solely composed of Spaniards that serves for the longest in the British Army. It's disbanded in March 1946. Basically, they always had an officer who was British, a sergeant major who was British, and some of the NCOs were British, and some of the officers were British as well. Every now and again, what they would try and do with that company, especially, is they would try and get hold of British officers who had, say, for example, lived in South America and people like that. And actually, by the end of the war, the number one Spanish company has a Venezuelan expat OC, so he's British, but he's brought up in Venezuela. And the sergeant major is one of the Spaniards that joined the company at the beginning of the war. So you do get that, and that works pretty well. All the NCOs are Spanish who are in the company, et cetera, et cetera. And you get exactly the same with the 63 Spaniards who joined the Middle East Commandos. They are told to elect their own NCOs. They do, and most of those have been NCOs or either in the Spanish Civil War, or even officers in some cases, or with the French as well. They've been NCOs with the French, so that that kind of makes sense. With the pioneers that join up in North Africa in 1942, 1943, pretty much the same thing. A lot of the NCOs are Spanish. But the officers are British. So yeah.
I was just wondering whether it was that sort of British Army tradition of, I suppose in, the colonial legacy in many ways, that you have large numbers of people functioning within British Army structures, Indian Army, etc., who don't speak English, but they're officered by English people, and whether that sort of system is used or that tradition is used in a way,
Yes.
maybe that shapes thinking in the British
Yeah,
Army.
no, I mean, very much so. I mean, the way I see the just over 1,000 Spaniards who served the British Army is really as part of that tradition, really, in many ways. They are regarded as aliens. They serve in alien units, but they are still part of the tradition of the British Army taking in these people. We're talking about an army of the Empire, aren't we? We're not talking about a British army. We're talking about an army of the Empire. And we are talking about a lot of them having, in the majority, having British officers and in some cases British NCOs. I mean, there are some really funny examples of the language barrier being a huge issue. Something that will feature in my book. Some really funny incidents of, you can't help but think of Fawlty Towers a little in that regard. But actually, that didn't stop them from being less motivated. They were still very motivated to do their job once they joined the British Army. And the biggest thing I found is how proud they were. Spaniards were really proud of being members of the British Army. A lot of them were very touched by their treatment from British NCOs and British officers. They really found that there was a lot more. It was a lot more of a humane way of doing business, and that made them a lot more motivated and a lot more willing to get on with what they did.
So how, I suppose, coming on to the sort of all the various Spaniards who end up in the British Army and the Free French Army during the Second World War, how did they, quotes, perform, and what motivated them, in many ways to fight for a foreign army in a world war when, you think, well, essentially, the conflicts in our country has ended, the fascists have won there. What keeps them going, and how good were they, and were there any sort of major disciplinary problems with them?
I mean, I've tracked down quite a few to disciplinary. I tracked down quite a few incidents of people deserting and never coming back. So there are out of the 1,070, there are a couple of dozen who have deserted. But that's no different really to the rest of the army. So I don't think that's a huge thing. Yes, there were some incidents. There were a couple of incidents in the UK where Spaniards were fighting each other, and there was a knife fight between two Spaniards. One of them killed the other in self-defense, turns out. There were also a couple of Spaniards who were trained by the SOE. A lot of the number one Spanish company were put on immediate alert to and trained as members of the SOE soon after that company was formed, because of all the plans that Britain was aware of Germany wanting to invade the Iberian Peninsula should Spain not enter the Second World War. So a lot of these Spaniards were put onto SOE training, and there were a couple of them that got in quite a lot of trouble. One of them ended up, or both of them were basically put under house arrest. One of them in more severe house arrest than the other, because he actually physically sold some of the SOE secrets to the Spanish embassy in London. So that's quite a big thing. But he was actually married. He'd married by that stage. He'd married a Brit, and he had a couple of children, and therefore, again, the British did show leniency in that regard, and he was just held until the end of the war and then released, because by then, obviously, there were no secrets to sell as such. So yeah, there were disciplinary problems. There was another incident where a Spanish soldier actually physically shot a French officer in North Africa, and he was summarily executed as a consequence. Still carried out by the British Army in World War II, and he, the accounts I have are that he took it with good grace, because he knew he was wrong. So there was that. But the motivation aspects of the Spaniards fighting was a huge thing, in many ways. So you've got kind of slight extremes. You've got Spaniards, say, for example, members of the Spanish number one company, number one Spanish company, that once they get into the SOE training, we're talking about over 100 of the 250 or so Spaniards in number one Spanish company who are put onto SOE training. They're very motivated, extremely motivated. I mean, the irony of that is, of course, is that one of their trainers is Kim Philby, who himself is fairly left-wing orientated, as we will find out later, obviously, in history. So it's really, really fascinating to see how they were motivated. And reading a lot of the reports, we're talking about not many of the Spaniards were really, really well educated. We're talking about a lot of the Spaniards. That's one of the big things that a lot of people don't realize is that a lot of the Spaniards that went into exile and ended up in France or North Africa were not necessarily the most educated elements. There were some that were, don't get me wrong, there are some very famous examples of that, but quite a lot of the more educated elements of the Spanish exile Republican movement were able to get away to, let's say, more safe countries, places like Mexico and Britain and places like that, at the end of the Spanish Civil War. And that left, like, let's say, the working class, mostly working class elements. So a lot of the Spaniards who ended up in the British Army were working class. They came from very, very basic backgrounds. So for them, the motivation was just to continue fighting, really, in many ways. Obviously, there was the political element. They knew that in many ways the fight was against fascism. And that really motivated them in many ways. But at the end of the war, of course, it really dug into them, because they realized that Franco was never going to be deposed by the Allies. So that became a bit of a sore point for many other Spaniards who had gone into exile, who had served the British Army, mostly because that's what they were wanting to do. They were motivated to keep on fighting to defeat fascism, and were motivated to ensure that Franco was part of that list of fascist dictators that were going to be stopped from doing what they were doing. So that political element was pretty important. And the final thing, I think, on that front is this endurance that some of these people had. I'll give you an example. There's one guy, Esteve, his name is, incredible kind of story. He fights in the Spanish Civil War, he flees over to France, he's exiled, he's interned, he joins the French Foreign Legion, he ends up in Syria, He crosses over to Palestine. He joins the British Army. He is a member of 50 Middle East Commando. He fights in several operations, but he fights in Crete, survives. Quite a lot of Spaniards in Crete were made prisoner. He survives that. He then carries on going. He's part of one special service regiment, and kind of linked him with the SAS and things like that. In July 1943, he decides he's going to rejoin the infantry. He rejoins the infantry, and he becomes a member of 1st 5th Battalion, Queen's Royal Regiment, West Surrey. He lands in Salerno. He fights all the way to near Rome. By the end of 1943, he's moved to the UK. His battalion's moved to the UK, 7th Armoured Division, part of Normandy. He lands in Normandy and fights all the way to Hamburg and is part of the parade, the victory parade in Berlin in July 1945. That's a lot of endurance. That's incredible endurance, for somebody who's been fighting for near on 9 years, Spanish Civil War, France, Middle East, Italy, Germany. And he's a one of many, who I've written about in the book that really, you've got this amazing ability to keep going. Some of the guys who were in the SAS, I cannot fathom how they were able to be so mentally strong and keep going. They were very, very able to just have that motivation to keep going, whether it was political or not. I think it was just more mental and human endurance more than anything else.
And what happens to these guys after the war? Because obviously they can't return to Spain. They are going to be demobbed as the British Army contracts. And obviously we have the startings of the Cold War and the ideological alignment and accommodation with Franco and other unpleasant regimes around the world.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the Spaniards come together. So you've got the groups I've mentioned about in Britain and the ones in the Middle East, and then you've got the groups that end up joining the British Army in 1943, 1944. Some of those end up in the SAS. The majority end up in the Pioneer Corps, and ironically, a lot of the Pioneer Corps companies that have been serving end up in Britain in 1944. Some of those end up going to Normandy. And in and support number one Spanish company that also lands in Normandy in August 1944 and stays in on the continent of Europe until I think it's September 1945. But basically what happens is that you then have all these disparate groups of Spaniards that don't really know each other kind of meeting in Britain at the end of the war, apart from those who are demobbed and stay in North Africa or Italy. You're talking probably in the region of around 700, 750 Spaniards who end up in Britain at the end of the war. And those Spaniards who are in the number one Spanish company or who have served in the Middle East Commandos and have continued fighting or have served in the Middle East Commandos have been made prisoner of war because half of the 63 end up as POWs and spend from mid-1941 to April 1945 in prisoner of war camps. They all end up in Britain, and the Middle East Commandos, number one Spanish company, members of the SAS, they are pretty much given an automatic right to stay in Britain because of the nature of the roles they've had and the amount of service they've done. The issue comes with the Spaniards who have served in North Africa who end up in Britain at the end of the war. And the British authorities, which is kind of standard stuff, they decide that they're going to demob them initially in North Africa, which is where they have all enlisted, which is normal practice. And that gets kind of eventually that's put on hold, mostly because a group of the Spaniards from one of the Spanish companies from North Africa get a team of, and they're all politicized anarchists. They manage to get a group of people together, and one of the leaders of this is a guy called Agustin Buenaventura. And by that stage, the Labour Party has won the elections, and they've got a pretty good argument with the Labour government. So they have a delegation. They're still in uniform. A lot of these men aren't demobbed until the summer of 1946, but we're talking late 1945, and they send a small delegation on leave to London. And they meet up with a lot of these politicians and with the Spanish exile groups that have already been in London for some time. And they managed to put their argument across, so much so that the British authorities put that all on hold. And then about 4 or 5 months later, so we're into 1946 by this stage, weirdly, the British authorities then decide they're going to be demobbed in Italy. And you've got this irony where a lot of them have been in Britain, they've settled down, they've married British, they've got British wives, some of them have even got children by this stage, and they're going to be demobbed in Italy and sent to Italy. And the irony, of course, of it is that there were lots of Poles who were in Italy who wanted to stay in Italy and were being demobbed in Britain, and Spaniards who were in Britain who were going to be demobbed in Italy. So it was there's a well-known cartoon and of a picture of a Spaniard saying goodbye to his bride to get onto the ship, and then in the distance you can see another ship leaving Italy to come to Britain. It's all very, very strange. So eventually they are given the opportunity to stay. What also happens is quite a few of them decide not to stay in Britain. A couple of hundred decide to go to Mexico, but the rest all settle in Spain, as in Britain, sorry. Can't go back to Spain, of course, and I'll talk about that in a bit. Basically they settle in Britain, and what they do is the majority gravitate to London. A lot of the established Spanish exile groups that were established after the Spanish Civil War are in London, of course. Many of them by that stage leave Britain. Quite a lot of the politicians and the senior Republican members of the Republican movement move on. And that void is filled by a lot of these Spaniards. As I say, London is like the epicenter, but there's a large group in the Midlands, Birmingham, Coventry, Derby. There's also a small packet up in the northeast. A lot of them work in the steel up there. Quite a few of the members of the Spanish Number One Company who are demobbed in the southwest, or who spend the last few months of their time in non-British Army uniform, end up settling down in the southwest. Right in Cornwall or even in Devon, places like that. So you get a real mixed bag, and they all start to settle down and kind of start families. Quite a few of the Spaniards have got families already. They've got their wives and their children who are still back in Spain. 1947, the British authorities allowed them to come over, so you get a small wave of Spanish families, or what's left of families, coming over, wives and children only. Some amazing stories there with that. And then you've also got quite a few Spaniards who end up marrying other exiled Spaniards who've been there for a while. So, for example, you've got the Basque refugee children. Quite a few of the Basque refugee children, girls, women who stayed in Britain during the war and at the end of the war, end up marrying some of these Spaniards who ended up serving in the British Army. So it's all a bit of a mishmash. And of course, they can't go back to Spain. Most of them are on blacklists. Quite a lot of them start applying for British naturalisation and get British passports at the end of the 1940s and are able, as a consequence, to visit Spain, visit their relatives. A lot of them just know that if they cross over the border, they're going to be automatically arrested. So for many of them, they're not able to actually see their families until Franco dies in 1975. One of the big things that's quite interesting is this whole idea of kind of historical memory as well. The Spaniards were very good at kind of keeping their motivation going. Even after the Franco, they know that Franco's going to survive. And obviously, in the early 1950s, we're talking about Franco actually being fully endorsed by the United Nations, and the Cold War has kicked in fully, and Spain's signed deals with the Americans about putting NATO bases, etc., etc., in or American bases in Spain as part of the kind of Cold War. So the kind of emphasis then turned to opposition to the regime, and there are quite a few Spaniards who are very kind of still politicized and want to do their bit to call out the atrocities still being done by the Franco regime in Spain. And as a consequence of that, in the late 1950s, the Spanish Ex-Servicemen's Association is formed. It formally starts in 1960, and they have a huge protest in Trafalgar Square when there is a visiting Franco regime politician coming to Britain, and it's frequented by quite a lot of Labour Party members. Lady Bonham Carter's there. You've got quite a lot of, very well established political writers. Some of the people who end up being the founding members of Amnesty are there as well. And the Spanish Excursionists Association keeps going throughout the 60s, but it is slightly watered down because by the mid 1960s, you've had the second large wave of Spaniards coming to Britain, who are part of the economic migrants who are not tainted by the politics in the same kind of way. They're a lot more neutral, or they've already been tainted by the Franco regime in that regard, and therefore aren't as politically motivated. So that kind of starts to water itself down a bit, but they still keep going. The Spanish Excursionists still meets, the association still meets up. The organized Spanish number one Spanish company, that they have meetings two or three times a year. They meet up in London quite a lot, quite often, kind of, and they have a bit of a an internal kind of support system where they raise funds for families and things like that. Quite a lot of the Spaniards don't marry and have families, and they're on their own. They've got nobody to lean on because all their families are back in Spain. That can be quite hard. And only a month, only literally only a month before Franco dies in October 1975, the Spanish Excursionists Association carries out a march, and they lay a wreath on the cenotaph, because that's their right, they're allowed to. And then they deliver a letter protesting about this Franco regime, because even though Franco was on his way out, and it was very clear that he was dying, it had been for some time, the regime was still coming down heavy on a lot of people. So they're protesting against that as well. They deliver a letter to 10 Downing Street. And literally 3 or 4 weeks later, Franco dies. So they keep going. And then obviously Spain then enters a lot of turmoil post the death of Franco. But then you have a Spanish constitution formalized in 1978, and then proper democratic elections taking place. And by that stage, by the time you're getting to those democratic elections and the constitution being written in 1978, we're talking about a lot of these, especially the more politicized Spaniards, going back to Spain for the first time, and being able to be part of the political campaigns of a lot of the parties that were then allowed to return to Spain, because a lot of them had been banned from Spain as a consequence of the Franco regime. So they, it was a big deal. But a lot of the Spaniards still loved Britain, and a lot of the Spaniards didn't leave Britain. They stayed in Britain. They may have gone back to Spain to visit their families. They may have retired to Spain once they finished working. And they all looked fondly. A lot of the memoirs I've been given by the families, I've interviewed over 50 families for the research I've done. That more than far more than that. I have families get in touch with me every week. It's incredible, with memoirs and things like that. And you can see that the service they had in the British Army really had a profound effect on them, because they were treated as human beings a lot more. That didn't stop them from continuing that fight and being motivated politically. And of course, that was a at times could be tricky when you're trying to be apolitical as part of an army. An army is trying to stay apolitical, but obviously you're fighting a political war, aren't you, in a Second World War, so it's a very difficult thing to manage. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of them, on the whole, they look back fondly at their time in the British Army, and they were really pleased that they were able to do their small part. That's one of the reasons why I've done the research and I've written the book. It's just to kind of thank them for their service as such, and be able to kind of give them their due deserts when it comes to recognition, albeit in a small way.
Now, talking of the book, when is that due out? Well, we're recording in August, so is it coming shortly?
Yeah, in the next month, it should be out in the next month. I've got a series of launch events in early September, so you can look out for those. The main launch event is going to be on the 6th of September at the National Army Museum. So that's going to be a big event. I'm also doing a few other events, which I haven't got dates for yet, but I will be doing something at the Imperial War Museum as well, probably the week after the 6th. That's the main launch event, like I say, the National Army Museum. And that will also be available live online as well. You can come in person. I'll be doing book signings on that day as well. That's the main launch event. The following weekend, I'm also going to be attending a World War II festival in Chatham at the Royal Engineers Museum on the 14th. And there's a few other events happening the previous week to that and the week after. So yeah, so plenty going on. Happy for people to get in touch and ask questions. And yeah, I mean, hopefully, as I say, the book will kind of show that the Spaniards and the British Army were part and parcel of the traditions of the British Army. Yes, they were politically motivated, but there were people that just kept on going. They had that kind of moral courage to keep going, and very much part and parcel of the British Army we know of today. The traditions of the British Army we know today, a far more inclusive army of today. And the Second World War brought people like these Spaniards, these Churchill Spaniards, into that as well.
And on that bombshell, I'll say, Sean, thank you very much for your time.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.